beautiful downtown Milheim, in the smack dab center of the Keystone State, this is Lou Bryson with Seen Through a Glass, the podcast that's mostly about food and drink in central Pennsylvania. Welcome to episode 38. The forecast calls for haze. No, it's not a show about the weather. It's a show about the most popular craft beer trend in a long time, hazy IPA. You see them everywhere, even at my belovedly traditional Elk Creek Cafe here in Milheim. Well, Yingling hasn't made one yet, but they're more and more the exception. Hazies drive some older brewers crazy because they put so much work and time and money into filtering their beer to make it clear like it's supposed to be. The previous IPA that ruled the taps was the so-called West Coast IPA, which was brutally bitter and brilliantly bright, clear as glass in its best presentations. Hazy IPA is none of that. It's not very bitter, although I have seen some hazies that try to straddle the West Coast IPA line as a type of hybrid. Hazy IPAs are also, duh, hazy. The amount of haze varies, from just kind of a light haze that you can still see through clearly, to a translucent shimmer, to something that looks like an orange milkshake, completely opaque. Brewers have done some crazy stuff with hazies, like adding edible glitter, adding lactose for an even more milkshake-like beer, and colors as bright as a poison dart frog. None of that has really stuck, but hazy IPAs continue to dominate tap lists, despite all the chatter about the year of the lager or old brewers shaking their fists at the clouds in the beers. Why do we like hazies? And what makes them different? And why are they, you know, hazy? Because they're not hazy for the same reason a German wheat beer is, the unfiltered yeast that stays in the beer. And it's not an artificial haze either. There's a reason for the haze, and it has to do with how the beer is made. We're going to talk about all that, and we're going to start with an interview with New Trail Brewing founder Mike LaRosa. It's not just about hazies, because there's a lot of other stuff I wanted to ask him, like about how New Trail has exploded out of Williamsport over the past 6 years. But New Trail has largely hung their hat on IPA, so I figured we'd get it from them. What else? Well, the Hoppy Valley Brewers Fest is almost here, so that's going to be the sponsor segment. I also judged a whiskey competition this month, and I'll give you a peek into that, then I'll tell you about two delicious stops I made on the way home from New Trail. We'll get to all that, but first, here's what I'm drinking today. What I'm drinking today is Mini Supercell, a tiny cold IPA from New Trail, a collaboration with Old Thunder Brewing from Pittsburgh. See, while we were walking around the brewery, Mike said smelling a glass of Mini Supercell was like sticking your nose into a sack of fresh hops, and then made it irresistible by mentioning that it was a tiny cold IPA, weighing in at only 3.75%. I had to try it. Quickly, though, a cold IPA is an IPA made with a significant portion of non-malt grains, like oats or dried wheat or rice, to lighten up the body, and then fermented with ale yeast, but matured at a colder temperature. Think a hazy IPA hop character with the smooth body of a lager. Let's get on this. Well, no lie, that smells like fresh hops right in the bag. And I sometimes complain about a shy nose on a beer. This doesn't have it. This one comes out to meet you. So much hop character. And what is it? It's, oh, there's pine. There's a little bit of passion fruit. Oh, some nectarine. And the little sweet clementines. Clementines, oranges. There's a lot going on there. This is just a tiny bit hazy. Actually, it's not. It's perfectly clear. It was beaten up on my glass. Let's have a sip. All those flavors come through. There's just a little bit of bitterness. It's enough to balance out the beer. It is light-bodied. It's actually lighter-bodied than the IPLs I've had. People do an India Pale Lager. This is actually the best of both worlds. Wow. Great hop aroma. Great flavor. And 3.75 comes in a 16-ounce can. You can have a couple of those and have a couple more. I like this. Mini Supercell. Now, before we get going on the hazy IPAs, it's time for Smack Dab in the Center, sponsored by the Happy Valley Adventure Bureau. Happy Valley Brewers Fest is on May 11th. This is the very first ever beer festival at Beaver Stadium, the fourth largest stadium in the world. Yeah, really, I looked it up. Not just in America, not just football, the fourth largest in the world. And the fest is right on the field. Have you ever been on the field in Beaver Stadium? I mean, the ticket's worth it just for that. But wait, there's more! Like beer, right? How about 74 breweries? And there may still be more before it's all said and done. Breweries from all across Pennsylvania, including your local favorites from Central PA, plus breweries from upstate New York, Delaware, even Rhode Island. So many beers to choose from. What else? Well, there's five live bands throughout the day, and the great Beaver Stadium food concessions with soft pretzels, cheesesteaks, and their world-famous chicken baskets. There are regular admission tickets for the 1 to 5 main session and a VIP option for an extra hour starting at noon. It comes with a nice gift bag as well. Parking is included in both tickets. And yes, as of May 1st, VIP tickets were still available. There's also a designated driver ticket. So think about staying safe. Go to the website at hoppyvalleybrewersfest.com for more information and to get tickets. You save $20 off day of fest entry. See you at Beaver Stadium. Let's get to that interview so we can all learn about Hazy IPA. Like I said, I went to New Trail Brewing. It's just outside of Williamsport, to talk to brewery partner and head of brewing operations, Mike LaRosa. We sat down to talk and then took a tour of the place. It's large, and Mike was saying they actually might outgrow it in 3 or 4 years. We stepped into the silos of some huge fermenters outdoors. We took a look at a filler that was running at around 250 cans a minute. We saw both brew kettles, the old 15-barrel one and the new 60-barrel. They're still using both of them. And we had some fresh off the filler cans of The Pathway, a nice bright West Coast IPA. Yeah, about that West Coast IPA. Before we get to the actual interview, let's run through a few terms that Mike and I throw around, like West Coast IPA. That's a style of IPA that was common before hazies. Clear, amber gold with a citrus or pine aroma, and sometimes crushingly bitter. Which brings up another term you'll hear, IBUs. These are international bittering units, a number for measuring how bitter a beer is. Pilsner Urquell is 40 IBUs, Sierra Nevada Pale Ale is 38, Stone IPA is 72. The IBU wars, Mike mentions, were a weird period about 20 years ago when brewers were trying to find ways to make their beers ever more bitter, because that's what the utmost fringe of beer geeks wanted. That bitterness comes from hops, which are green, cone-shaped flowers that have a wide variety of aromas and varying levels of bitterness. There are different strains of hops, just like there are different strains of grapes for winemaking, and the hops bring a similar difference to the beers. Some more about hops. You'll hear us talk about kettle hopping. This is where hops are added to the boiling beer at stages during brewing, which makes the beer bitter. Each separate addition is called a charge, and dry hopping, where hops are added to the fermented cold beer in the tank to maximize hop aroma. Let's see. Mike also mentions caramel, which comes from roasting the malted grain to develop sugars, and then, with more roasting, caramel. We'll also mention the CBC that he was at last week in Las Vegas. That's the annual Craft Brewers Conference. It's a big trade expo for the industry. I think that's about it. Let's roll the interview. Hey, I'm at New Trail Brewing with brewer, founder, co-founder, Mike LaRosa.
Yeah, director of brewing operations and partner is my preferred title.
All right. And let's get right to that. What was your path here? How'd you get here?
Started brewing professionally about 14 years ago. I started at the Rock Bottom in King of Prussia.
No way.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I worked with Brian.
With Brian?
Yeah.
Yes. Brian McConnell.
Yeah. And who now has Sterling Pig.
Yeah. Yeah. I did a show there about 2 years ago. What's Brewing PA show I do. Yeah. We went to Sterling Pig. Actually, that was my first show.
Yeah. I mean, Brian provided me a wealth of knowledge, a great foundation.
Wow, I didn't know that. Yeah.
Brian had been brewing professionally, I think, around 15 years. Yeah. The point that I worked with them. Yeah. This would have been I don't know, 2010 or so that I worked with Brian. I worked with him for about 2 years, and then there just wasn't an opportunity for me to grow. I was in college at the time. I have a degree out of Albright College in Reading.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yep. It was started as an internship, and then he offered me a job to stick on, and there just wasn't room for growth. You know, there's only one assistant and one head, so... Right. I moved on, and I was one of the first brewers at Saucony Creek in Kutztown.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. I worked with them for about a year, and then, like every brewer does in Philadelphia, I worked for Maniunk Brewing for a few months.
Wow, I didn't really expect this to be such a trip down memory lane, but there you are.
Yeah, so I worked with Maniunk for less than 6 months or so.
Okay.
And then I was offered the head brewing job at Kane Brewing on...
Kane in New Jersey.
New Jersey or Asbury Park.
Yep.
Worked with them for a little over a year, and then I was headhunted by Gene out of Tired Hands.
Okay.
And I built the fermenteria and the dispensary for him. And then from there, I started a consulting company. So I worked with startup businesses, startup breweries specifically, getting them basically from business plan to... through their first month of operation was kind of like my wheelhouse. Design, build out, equipment acquisition, you know, just the things that they don't know that I knew how to do from building a bunch of breweries along the way. And that led me to New Trail. My my then clients are now my partners. And they were restaurateurs. They have owned something in the neighborhood of 17 liquor licenses since 2001.
And they mostly around here?
It's been central and northwestern Pennsylvania primarily.
Okay.
Three of us are solely here.
Okay. So. And how did it wind up in Williamsport?
Well, so their original businesses were in Williamsport.
Oh,
so
okay. All right.
They opened the Cell Block. It's a memorable date. They opened the Cell Block, which was their first liquor license, a nightclub in an old jail cell, on September 13th, 2001. Both Dave and Charles, my primary business partners, are not from Williamsport, but they had gone to college in the area.
Okay.
One in Mansfield and the other one at Pennsylvania College of Technology, and they just ended up here. So I was just happened to be out consulting, running around, had an ad up, and they contacted me, and we worked well together, and they offered me equity to stay.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why New Trail? Where's the name come from?
Well, so originally, it might have been a placeholder, but the original name for New Trail Brewing Company was called Williamsport Brewing Company.
Wow.
Yeah. And one of the first things I said to them as a consultant was like, well, it's not 1995. Let's pick a different name. And, it was their intention to pick a different name, but it's funny, all the original documents, my original documents to them, and the original documents that I have from, like, the equipment quotes that I got all say Williamsport Brewing Company on them. But we worked together on it, and all four of us are pretty big outdoorsmen. My one business partner is pretty big into cycling, off-road cycling. I'm a pretty big kayaker. I was a big rock climber as a kid. My other business partner's hike and camp and stuff like that. And I mean, Williamsport itself is so beautiful.
Oh yeah.
North central Pennsylvania is just so, so beautiful. Yeah. So the idea was to kind of draw attention to the greater beauties that we have up here in northern central Pennsylvania. And so was born New Trail.
There you go. There you go. I want to talk about the space. It's kind of industrial, kind of retro. What was this building before, and why did you decide to leave it essentially close to what it, I assume, what it looked like?
Well, as you might know, the Williamsport was the lumber capital of the world at one point.
Right.
And it had more millionaires per capita compared to anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at the houses,
you
can see it.
Exactly. Yeah. So where the tasting room and our hot side room is located is in the original Dodge Planing Company building.
Oh.
So as you drove in, you probably parked in the parking lot outside, and you can see that the river is not too far away from us there. Before the highway existed that breaks the river to us, the parking lot used to be a float pond. So they used to drag logs in off of the river and plane them in our building. So two more fun facts about our building, is that the founder of Little League specifically worked in our building.
Oh, wow.
And the other fun fact that I have about our building is that we have no idea what year it was built in.
Really?
Yeah, because...
just gonna happen.
Well, so there was a fire in downtown Williamsport. I want to say the year was 1911 or 1912, and Old City Hall was burnt down. So we lost
the records
all the records. Okay. So anything that was built prior to 1911 or 12 or whatever the year is now listed as the year of the fire on the document. But we have suspicion that the building was built in the late 1800s, possibly the 70s, based off of the bricks that are in our building.
Okay.
They're stamped with a company that went out of business in the early 1900s.
Right. New Trail South, the company, I cannot believe you just celebrated 6 years. Your growth has been stunning.
It seems like yesterday and also 20 years ago.
Kind of like the pandemic. Gosh. I mean, you've become one of the most talked about breweries in Pennsylvania. Your beers show up all over. How did this happen? Was there a plan? Did it just... I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the original aspirations that my business partners and I had for New Trail, we've far surpassed.
Okay.
I'd say the essential core idea behind New Trail was to make really good liquid and distribute it locally.
Okay. What's your distribution area now?
We're in four states now. So okay. We're Pennsylvania, all of Pennsylvania, all of Maryland. If we're not all of Maryland, we will be by the end of next month. All of New Jersey and all of West Virginia. West Virginia just opened up for us about 2 months ago, I bet. And originally we wanted to make really good liquid and service the 10, 12, 15 surrounding counties to Lycoming County, where Williamsport's housed. And things went well. The liquid was received well, and people wanted to buy it.
People wanted it.
Yeah, so we just kept saying, Philadelphia wants some. We'll put it in Philadelphia. Oh, yeah, Pittsburgh wants some. Oh, yeah, we'll put it in Pittsburgh. Oh, yeah, Erie wants some. And then I guess we are growing a little bit faster than we anticipated.
Better order some tanks.
Yeah, we better order some tanks and put in some infrastructure. And then, here we are 6 years later. Yeah. We anticipate being named somewhere between the 60th and 70th largest craft brewery in the country this year. Last year we were named the 97th or 98th largest.
6 years in.
6 years in, yeah.
Yeah. That's. This says a lot about the quality of the beer.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
And about the quality of the salespeople, too.
It's all about the basics here. It's really good liquid. It's a really good sales team. It's really good marketing. And the price point's right.
Yeah, IPAs. People talk a lot about your IPAs. Broken Heels, Double Broken Heels, Replenish. IPAs sell, for sure, and everybody brews them. Are you an IPA brewery?
Yeah, I would very much say we're an IPA brewery.
Okay.
I'd say that of the, call it 50-ish thousand barrels we produced last year, I'd bet that close to 41,000 barrels were in IPA.
I mean, I got to be honest with you. It's kind of refreshing to hear somebody actually own it for a change.
Oh, yeah. No, I'll own it.
Because usually you ask that question like, oh, no, we make other things too.
Well, we do make other things.
You do it well.
Yeah,
but
the other, the majority of the other, call it 10,000-ish barrels that were missing is primarily in lager, specifically in domestic style lager, crisp lager.
Crisp, yeah. We'll get to crisp.
Yeah, I figured we might.
Yeah. But I really do want to talk about hazy IPAs particularly, because I've seen a lot of different beers that call themselves hazies, and I've heard a lot of explanations about what a hazy is. So let's get down into the weeds. What is a hazy IPA? Is there a difference between hazy and New England? What kind do you make here? And what makes it hazy? So let's go.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really glad you're asking me this question.
Really?
Because I'm very opinionated about
it.
So as we might remember, the IBU wars happening in the late 90s and early 2000s really defined, I'd say, West Coast IPA.
Yeah.
And then there was this kind of like counterculture movement on the East Coast that was happening right after the IBU wars that became what we would have called East Coast IPA or No Coast IPA.
Okay.
And that was still bitter, but it was starting to focus a little bit more on aromatics as compared to just like 150 IBU West Coast caramel driven IPA.
Yeah, let me see your face now.
Exactly. Okay, and this was like, I'd say 2010-ish was about when this was all happening. And then there was almost like another counterculture movement to that started happening in New England in the Mid-Atlantic. And those beers started becoming almost entirely aroma-driven, no bitterness, and pale as compared to what we would have been making in the late 90s throughout the aughts. That was,
I'd say,
amber, copper, yeah, maybe burnt gold on the lighter side of those colors. But they, you know, what was happening in New England and in the Mid-Atlantic was that we were not filtering them. We were much more interested. We were over dry hopping, over whirlpool hopping, and way more interested in
and just to be clear, when you say over, you mean compared to West Coast?
Yes, I'm sorry. Compared to what the West Coast West Coast or American counterparts were happening at that
time. Yeah, I don't want to get judgmental with the over.
No. I'd say
full throttle.
Exactly. So, so there was, I'd say, four or five major breweries in the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast that were making these beers. And, you know, obviously Treehouse, Trillium.
Right.
The Alchemist is kind of like the stepdad or the godfather of that movement.
Yeah.
And then Tired Hands, of course. Mm-hmm. And where I think there's a distinctive classification difference between New England IPA and Hazy IPA, because I think they're very, very close, mm-hmm, is primarily in bitterness.
Oh, okay.
New England IPA, to me, is almost no bitterness. We're talking like sub 15, sub 20 IBUs.
Wow, okay.
All right. That's where I think a lot of, like, you know, Julius or those beers that are coming out of New England, mm-hmm, live in. Whereas, like, we make Hazy IPA, which I think is a little bit more balanced and a little bit more West Coast, quote unquote.
Almost hybrid-y. And it's bitter.
Yeah, we're in the, like, I'd bet 40-ish IBU spot. We don't measure IBUs. It's not overly important to us. For me, it's more about balance than it is about...
How's it taste?
Exactly. Yeah. Than it is about just let me throw as much aromatics at you as I can.
And how's that work? Is it largely a thing of not putting anywhere near as much hops in the kettle? Are you putting any hops in the kettle?
Yeah. So okay. I mean, like, we it's a 90-minute boil. There's a 75-minute addition for specifically for bitterness. And Broken Heels, I can tell you, has three different kettle charges, late addition kettle charges.
Okay.
A lot of our one-off IPAs receive 1 to 2. So
and then just
a whole lot in the dry hop.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is and this is during fermentation, post fermentation.
Post fermentation. Yeah. We wait until terminal gravity.
Okay. And then are you doing any hop jacking or hop torpedo or any of that stuff, or is it just straight
in over the top for us?
Okay. All right. The haze. What is the haze?
Well, it comes from being angry.
I'm really sorry this is audio only, because the face was half the joke.
No, that is my joke. Haze for us can come a bit from our yeast selection, a lot from the amount of protein and enzymatic activity that we'll have during our mashing process. So we'll use a mixture. We're Pilsner as a base malt for everything that we do.
Okay.
And then it's a mixture of... flaked oats, flaked wheat, oat malt.
Okay, so there is some of those protein-heavy grains going in there. Yeah. Okay. Yep. All right. But you're not adding.
No. There's not just like liquid haze.
I know there are so many people who are just like, oh, they're just putting flour in them.
Well,
no.
Yeah. That all came from a joke in a podcast.
I know.
Yeah. Like, yeah. We at Tired Hands, we never actually. Well, before we said it, we never really used flour in anything that we did. But yeah.
Oh, man, that has such legs on it. So we'll kill that.
Yeah. That's about as much as I'll say about that.
The other question I had, hop selection.
Sure.
I mean, that's a big part of
it,
right?
Huge portion of what we do.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I go to the Yakima Valley once a year. It's usually late September based on the number of hops that I'm selecting. They're all harvested by the time that I'm out there.
Okay.
I think last year I selected... 12 hops, 12, you know, 10, 12 different styles.
And there literally are new ones every year, right?
As far as new strains?
Styles,
yeah. I mean, it's a long process to get to a new literal hop. But yeah, generally they're excited about something new every year.
And this is all like crossbreeding, or it's not...
Yeah, so I mean, it's agronomic, so they're...
They're not doing genetic engineering.
A little bit,
okay.
But it's primarily agronomic. So they're looking at like Centennial, for instance. Centennial, uh-huh, as we know, is like very high in pine. It can be... citrus driven, but it is not a great yielding hop.
Okay.
Not always. Some years it yields high and some years it yields low. So the farmers are obviously much more interested in high yields. So
sure.
They're like, well, can we make the same hop but make it higher yielding? So that's sometimes the innovations that they're talking about when I'm in the Yakima Valley. And sometimes
yield disease resistance.
Yeah, and sometimes it's something totally new. Recently, HBC, the top breeding company, 586 has been really, really big for them. They're making a big push on that. That's pineapple, guava, citrus-driven hops.
Because that's a large part of the characteristic of these beers. Is
exactly.
That,
yeah.
Tropical, stone
so,
fruit.
One that I'm relative more familiar with would be Sabro and Talus. Sabro.
Okay.
Was a big push for them, I'd say, about 5 or 6 years ago. That's very coconut-driven, whereas they were able to take, I want to say it was a daughter of Sabro, a daughter strain of Sabro,
mm-hmm.
and make a hop called Talus, which is way more pina colada as compared to just like straight, I like to call it like blue coconut, like you would...
the drinks,
like a blue coconut drink. This one's a little bit more balanced, like pina colada.
Okay.
So, I guess I do want to finish my thought.
Go ahead.
So not only am I talking when I'm in Yakima Valley with the growers about what's new and exciting, we're also literally rubbing hops and selecting based off of different acreages. So Citra is
and
one
just
of
the, for the listeners, rubbing hops. You're talking about literally rubbing a hop between your hands.
Yeah, let them smelling them. Yep,
a big
exactly.
Smell. Yeah. Okay.
Yep. So Citra, for instance, can present more. Clementine or navel orange, or it can be more like grapefruit and bitter, and
depending on
the acre, really. I mean, the farm, so
ooh,
the soil,
terroir here, okay.
Yeah, terroir, yeah, exactly, yeah. So for us, it's really important to go select our big hops. I mean, we're not spending a little amount of money on hops.
I'll
so
bet.
I want to get the ones that I want.
Yeah. So there really is a is it fair to say there's a larger volume of hops because of the dry hopping as opposed to kettle charging? Or
oh, easily, yeah. We use way more in the dry hop than we use in the kettle.
Yeah. Okay. Are you doing much with non-American hops?
Not too much. I think, you know, we buy Tetnang. That's used in Lazy River.
Okay. Because I know a lot of guys are looking at the New Zealand stuff and just going
crazy.
Okay.
So it's funny. I sort of consider those domestic. Well, just because they're aroma-driven hops. You know, I don't really consider European hops to be aroma-driven the style of IPA
sure.
we make. Yeah, I was just in Vegas last week around this time.
CBC.
For CBC, And I was able to do my selection for my Southern Hemisphere hops. So we selected Nelson, Motueka, and Nectaron. And actually, my Nelson selection was really interesting. There was this woman that was floating around the selection booth, and she sort of just like comes over and starts like rubbing
the way, really?
Yeah. And I'm like, whoa, what the hell is this lady doing? And
hey,
I'm sitting
here,
there.
Try this. Come on.
Yeah. Well, and I'm like, I'm thinking she's just like some random person off the street that's like just wandered into this booth, and the people are just being polite to her.
Uh-huh.
And my New Zealand rep comes over and he tells me, I'm forgetting her name. He goes, this woman owns 20 breweries in New Zealand, and she was the first person to ever use Nelson Sauvin.
No way.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. In a beer. And I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, I'm like sort of like a little put off by the whole thing. And I'm like, oh my God, please come back over. Please help us select our Nelson. And, you know, we picked a good one. But, it, you know, it was fun to hear her tell us what she thought about Nelson.
Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah.
If someone's looking at, how many hazies do you usually have on at the tasting room?
At the tasting room? It's
three, four, five?
Yeah, four-ish, I'd bet. Four or five of the, how many taps do we have now? 16? Yeah,
okay,
16
so.
Now. Yeah, sometimes it's higher. Sometimes it might be 7 or 8. But I try to keep it pretty diverse.
But if you're looking at that many, how do you make a selection? Or do you just start trying?
As far as a selection off the
as
off
a
the
drinker.
Draft board?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, like, you know, Broken Heels is obviously our favorite. And if you like Broken Heels, you should drink Broken Heels.
Dude.
But if you're interested in trying other hops, there's almost always some fun combination or a grist combination on the list that's going to be intriguing. For me, like I like to drink what's new because I like to reflect on the hops that's on the list. But I mean, Broken Heels is almost as perfect as we can make it. So I think we make a lot of it. So,
there you go.
And it's really fresh.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a thing too. Yeah. How is freshness more important with hazies?
I'd say, yeah. I mean, freshness is extremely important in hazy IPA. I mean, now at the size that we're at right now, we like to focus on obviously freshness, but I want to make as shelf stable a beer as possible, you know, as shelf stable of a hazy as possible.
Okay.
How long, at what point is the best time for Broken Heels to be drank, and how long does it taste that perfect?
You know? And what are there elements in hazies that have a different effect on shelf stability?
I think so. I think yeast selection can be pretty important. I think the amount of protein-based or high-protein malts is important there. I'm just sort of talking about recipe development, but like the hops that you use, the hops that you select, but we also use a centrifuge as well.
So okay.
Like we're trying to pull out the larger chunks of haze that, mm-hmm. that would then settle to the bottom of the can and make it, you know, a really delicious beer at day 0 to day 14, but at day 14, we'll make it a really ugly beer, you know?
Oh yeah. So you want to try and pull that out
and make that stable. Yeah. So we're getting 60 to 90 days on it.
Pivot to lager.
Sure.
I mean, we already talked about it a little bit. I mean, I know you've got a good Pilsner of the Lazy River. I've been here. I've sat at the bar and drunk Lazy River, but I really want to talk about Crisp.
Yeah.
Because one of those times when I was sitting at the bar was a Friday afternoon before a major football game, and that shit was flying out of here.
Yeah, I mean, sure does.
Everyone was coming to the door, grabbing one, and walking out.
Yeah.
I mean, where did that come from? Why did you even make a beer like that?
I mean, Crisp is the beer that I always wanted to make.
Really?
Yeah, one of the first beers that I ever homebrewed was like a Moosehead clone, basically.
Okay.
You know, like it was just, you know, my parents grew up drinking craft beer with my dad and domestic lager with my mom. My mom drinks Coors Light, Miller Lite. My grandfather was a big Budweiser drinker.
And my dad was a High Life drinker.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, most brewers are big High Life drinkers.
Yes, that's true. So
Crisp was, you know, when marketing and sales came to me and said, like, you know, expecting a fight, because it's always a fight between, you know, production, and they're like, we'd like to make an American log, and they like didn't even finish. It's like, sold. Like, no arguments.
Okay, you know,
let's get it going. I'll have it in the tanks next week. So we trialed it. I don't know. We trialed probably 4 or 5 different batches, and they were all, you know, it's domestic lager. It's pretty, they're all pretty similar.
Pretty classic flavor.
Yeah. And we got, I'd say by the third or fourth one, we were like real, real close.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, here we are 2 years later, a year and a half later, something like that.
So something like that, technically and almost schedule-wise, how does that fit in compared to a hazy? I mean, is it...
It's much more difficult from a technical standpoint. I mean, lager is
unforgiving.
Is extremely unforgiving.
Yeah.
I mean, an IPA is extremely forgiving because you can hit it with just any amount of hops in the dry hop as you want to try to cover up stuff. I mean, we make very clean IPA, but lager, there's no like, well, I bet after we put dry hops in that'll taste a little bit better, you know.
Yeah.
So for us, the grist selection as well as the yeast and the actual fermentation time and what fermentation looks like is extremely important, not only to mention the actual lagering process, letting it clean itself up.
So how long from start to finish?
Oh, from grain to glass, you're asking? Oh, let's see. It's like a 24 to 30 day beer.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So it's getting a solid 14 days cold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. When marketing came to you and wanted to do that, I mean, was it about... I don't know, having another arrow in the quiver? Was there a specific target they were going for? Was it one of these, you know, local people want to drink our beer, but they're scared of IPAs?
I'd say it's yes and to everything you just said. I mean, obviously, we're a company. Our goal is to make money.
Sure.
You know, as much as I love craft beer and we love craft beer here, that, you know, we can only afford to do so if we continue to make money. So, I mean, obviously, there was an economic incentive to try to... diversify, and I guess that leads me to our next point, is that we intend to be a beverage company. You know, I don't just want to make hazy IPA. I don't just want to make crisp lager. I don't just want to make barrel-aged imperial stout. I want to have a lot of, like you said, arrows in my quiver that we can move from. And third, I mean, the brewers are just happy to have lager.
Okay.
For years and years and years of just making hazy IPA
and
Lazy River on the side, you know, it's nice to have something that we're all, I mean, we're all proud of all the beer that we make.
But sure.
Brewers are particularly proud of
because it ain't, like you said, not easy to do.
It's not easy to do.
Yeah. And especially something that clean.
Yeah, and Crisp itself has been fun for us because we're sort of expanding the brand family as we go along.
Well, that was what I wanted to get to because I mentioned this in email with you. I just saw the Crisp Lime.
Exactly, yeah.
In a New York Times ad.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I assume it's a regionally focused.
I'm sure it's regionally
focused. Yeah, because it was on the app. It wasn't in the actual print.
Yeah.
But I literally saw that 2 days ago. Is it that brand new?
Yeah. I'd say it's Crisp Lime's been on the shelves for four or five weeks now at this point. So, Crisp Lime is out in distribution, but we're also working on Crisp Amber right now, too.
Okay.
That'll start for us, I want to say, in September is the target date.
And
Amber Lager.
But, I mean, is it color? Is it body? Is it...
A little bit of both. We're sort of in the trial. We're starting to trial recipes for it and figure out what we want to make out of it. But my intention is to make something that's delicious, you know, both by flavor, color, and aroma. So,
okay. All right.
Yeah.
Wow. The Crisp family.
Yeah, Crisp brand family.
Okay. Maybe it is because of how clean Crisp is and how juicy the IPAs are. I was surprised to be so impressed by your big beers. Moonlit.
The
triple particularly was awesome. And I got some of the, what was it, Lager's Path collaboration you did with Trobes.
I haven't thought about that beer in a while.
Wow, that blew me away. I can't even remember where I found it. But I had one of those relatively recently. I remember John at Trobes just like, where the hell did you find that?
Yeah.
Well, not everybody can pull off a big beer that's that, I don't know, purposeful. I like to say it's, it says what it has to say without mumbling. Everything I had of yours that was big, because I was sitting running the taps one day because my wife was driving.
Sure.
And everything was like dead on the money. I mean, even beers that I was looking at and thinking, well, this is going to be a mess, was not. How do you do that with a big beer? What's the challenges of a big beer with a lot of stuff going on?
You know, I had talked about balance earlier when talking about IPA and hazy IPA, but balance is important in all beer. And for me with big beers, I think about it in layers. So I want to develop a nice base of whatever the style is, mm-hmm. and then I want to layer in on top of it from there. Does it need more caramel? Does it need more roast? Does it need more coffee, chocolate, etc.? And then just build the recipe that way.
Okay.
Obviously, fermentation is extremely important in big beers as well, as it is in all beer.
But do you use a different yeast on those?
Or? No, I'd say we run four different strains in-house.
Okay.
So...
And pretty much everything is just
pretty much those. Everything is our house ale strain.
Okay.
Including big beer.
Okay.
I'd say the outlier, we run a wit strain for the white ale.
Mm-hmm. Obviously got a lager strain.
There's a lager strain for lager. And then we run two ale strains. One of them being Cosmic Punch, which is used in some of our one-off IPAs as well as in a beer that's in our hoppy variety pack called Citrus Summit. And then I've got a house ale strain that's used for everything else.
Oh my God. Yeah. We never even get into the whole biotransformation and polyphenols and all
that. Yeah.
Maybe not get too far into the weeds.
Yeah. So I guess layering, is the quick answer on that one.
Well, no, I think the paying a lot of attention to the base beer is, I think that's a big key right there.
Yeah, I mean, specifically, I mean, to dive into a beer like Moonlit, Moonlit's at its core a British Imperial Stout, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I had designed it specifically to go into barrels, and I knew that for it to go into barrels, it sort of had to kind of be... I don't want to say blah, but it needed to be very accepting of the complementary flavors that would have come out of resting in a barrel for anywhere from 6 months to
the thing I like about it is you seem to have started with a fairly lean imperial.
Yeah. It's is it 8.5% at the base beer or so? So it's not, you know, it's not gonna like, it's not so chewy that you can't.
Yeah, reasonably well attenuated.
It's reasonably well attenuated so that, you know, it will accept those vanilla and tannin and oak flavors out of the barrel. So yeah.
More general question. Craft beer in general. Sales are down, more breweries have closed in the past year than maybe in the last 10. Clearly, every brewery is not having these problems. You're not. Trogs seems to be doing fine. Is there any thoughts on what it is you're doing different and what's going on in the wider market? Just spitballing.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that, I mean, we've all been talking about a bubble for a while.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like that there's going to be a bubble. And I think we're just sort of in a correction period right now. I mean, there's something like 10,000 breweries and more opening in the country at
still
the moment.
Still more opening, yeah.
And still more opening. I mean, at some point, the market's going to bear what it's going to bear. But I think as long as your business model is solid and you have a niche, you should be able to do just fine. We're definitely, as a market, losing, craft beer market as a whole, losing to RTDs or FMB or liquor in general.
Right.
And we're starting to age into... from that older millennial and Gen X period, we're having, I think, a trouble as a whole as an industry connecting with the next round of drinkers, this Gen Z crew. But I'm sure we'll figure it out. You know, beer's been around for, you know,
it's not going
forever. Away. I mean, it's what created society.
Yeah, this is why I don't really like the term bubble, because when a bubble goes away, there's nothing left.
Yeah, and that's why I said bubble, and I'm doing air quotes, which I know nobody's seeing, but I think it's more of just a course correction than anything else. I'd had an interesting conversation with Bart Watson the other day when I was
the numbers guy for
the numbers guy for the Brewers Association, and he's not worried about it at all. He said, you know, basically the same sort of tone that I'm saying, that, you know, there is certainly breweries that are going to open, and there's certainly breweries that are going to close, but the, you know, the ones that are figuring it out are going to be good. Everything's going to be fine. So
So what? I guess a wrap up question: Where do you go upward from here? Is new tap rooms, new beers? Are you looking at distilling?
I mean, like I said earlier, we are a beverage company. We're definitely
interested. That's what I wanted when you said that. Yeah,
we're definitely interested in distilling. Okay. I mean, the growth for us has obviously been tremendous and quick. So it's been hard to necessarily focus on something that would be so different compared to what we do now, but we're definitely interested in it. I wouldn't say that we're overly interested in tap room or acquisitions that way for tasting rooms or anything like that. But we want to be a regional brewery. You know, we want to produce really good liquid and service the Mid-Atlantic. You know, and if that grows, that's great. And if not, you know,
I mean, you're well along the way.
Yeah, maybe. Nothing but world domination.
That's all it will do.
Yeah. No, but I mean, really good liquid for local people. And if local grows larger, that's great.
Yeah. I actually remember, interview I did with Dick Yingling years ago, like maybe 25 years ago.
Wow.
And he said, you know, I was really happy when I found out that 45% of sales in Schuylkill County were Yingling. He said, that meant more to me than anything.
Sure.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and that's how we feel. We're definitely on the larger side for our local wholesalers, for their craft brands.
That's a great place to be.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, the mammoths of Yingling or Miller or Coors or Bud for our local guys are gonna keep the lights on for those wholesalers.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're starting to move into the number one, two, and three slot.
Yeah, to have that presence there is...
Yeah, which is wonderful.
Crucial. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. That's all I have. Thank you.
No, thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was. All right.
Boy, there's a lot going on at New Trail. You can listen to the visit I made in 2023 in Episode 7. Or, you know what? I could have another beer. Mike gave me a six-pack of the crisp amber that we talked about. It's still in development. Let's take that out for a spin. That's what else I'm drinking today. Oh, wow. Oh, that's just a great, great caramel malt aroma. Just enough lager hop to pull it into focus. That's a really nice smell. And the beer itself is gorgeous. It's a dark amber with this beautiful white head. Great looking beer. Good smelling beer. Well, that's pretty good. A lot of malt there. Yeah. Good flavor. Not too much flavor. Definitely not too little flavor. I will say the same thing I said to Mike. I think there's maybe just a little bit of extra sweetness at the end, at the very finish. He did say it was still in development, and they hadn't run it on the 60-barrel system yet. Apparently, the efficiencies are a little different than that or something. He thought it might make a difference, but this is good stuff. He says that's supposed to be coming along full strength in the fall, I think. Keep an eye out for it. Crisp amber. And of course, you can try the crisp with lime, too. I did not get to try that. I would, after this, I would be happy to give it a try. The tagline is apparently no assembly required. It's already got the lime put in. All right, back to hazies. So hazy IPAs are centered around a few things. There's the haze, which is a little bit of yeast plus proteins from the grains, some coming from the hops chemically interacting with the grain. There's the low bitterness, which comes from adding a lot of hops very late in the brewing process. And then there's the fruitiness, the juiciness, that comes largely from the choice of hops and all the new hop strains that are being bred for these aromas, but also from biotransformations that take place with compounds from the hops during fermentation. This was kind of controversial for a while, but has been proven to be real. And there are yeasts, like the Cosmic Punch that Mike mentioned, that have been optimized for these effects. And you know what? That's about as far into those weeds as we're going to get. Suffice to say, there are several different ways to get juicy aromas in a hazy IPA, including putting orange peel in it. There may also be a lower degree of what's called attenuation, which is how much sugar in the brew converts to alcohol. West Coast IPAs tend to ferment out drier than hazies. So that's all kind of nerdy, but it's better than saying, well, or hazy. Because if you've had one, you know there's a lot more to it than that. You know, when I was prepping for this episode, I came across a kind of quaint article from the American Homebrewers Association from 2003. What is beer haze and how to fix it? It makes old school brewers nuts. And when the first New England IPAs were coming out a little over 10 years ago, you would see pictures of them posted on social media by brewers asking, is this a beer or a glass of orange juice? But as my friend M. Sauter said in a piece she wrote about hazies last year, beer is always evolving. Just an aside here, there is some contention over when the first hazy IPA was made. Mike got into that a little in the interview. Some say it was Trillium Brewing's Julius in about 2012. Mike mentioned a beer to me earlier that his mentor, Brian McConnell, made at Rock Bottom in King of Prussia called Sub-Zero that was at least a hazy precursor. Some say Alchemist's Heady Topper in the mid-2000s was the first hazy. And some go all the way back to the venerable Greg Noonan at the Vermont Pub and Brewery in the mid-1990s. Greg was quite the innovator, but I tend to go with the more recent date. Admittedly, though, it's an open question. I do have one bone to pick with hazy IPAs, and it's partly brewers that are to blame, and partly us drinkers, which, honestly, is usually how this stuff works out. It's no secret, we like new beers. Ooh, is that new? I want to try it. It might be a fear of missing out, maybe a desire to get a badge on Untappd, and if you don't know about Untappd, please don't worry about it. It might just be that you want to try something different, but you want it. And brewers know that, and they know we like hazies, so a new hazy is like catnip, and it's relatively easy to get a new hazy by simply changing the dominant hop. Is that a new beer, or is it just a different flavor of the same beer? Because that hunt for different, or that hunt for gotta catch them all, has been driving brewing, and I honestly don't like the direction it's headed in. Not because people are having fun, I don't think that way, but because it's not sustainable. how long can you keep coming up with a new beer every week or two? And that's why I kind of liked it when Mike mentioned that if you like Broken Heels, it's pretty much perfect there at their tap room. So go get one. That's Hazy IPA, or New England IPA, or Juicy IPA, whatever you want to call it. Why does it continue to rain? Probably because it's fun. There's no bitter barrier to entry like West Coast IPA, and it's easy to appreciate. I have no snobbery about Hazy IPA. If that's what people want, have at it. I drink them myself sometimes. I like variety in my beer choices. So sometimes I'll have a Hazy IPA, sometimes a porter, sometimes a funky lambic, oftentimes a pilsner, and, well, every now and then I get the fruited sour with a dip of ice cream, because life's too short not to try stuff here in the smack dab center. I realize there's no food in this episode, and I don't like doing that. You gotta have something for everyone, right? So on the way back from New Trail, I took a little bit of a detour to a place I'd been wanting to check out for a while, Henry's Barbecue, along Route 220 in Linden, about 10 miles west of New Trail. I sat at their little counter and checked the menu. Barbecue sandwiches of ham, pork, turkey, beef, or Canadian bacon. This is a kind of central PA thing. It's sliced or chopped meat, basted and marinated in a sweet or spicy barbecue sauce, and served on a roll. It's kind of like a chunky, sloppy Joe. They're good. Maybe not classic barbecue. Okay, not at all something a Texan or Carolinian would recognize as barbecue at all, but tasty. But I went for the pig wings. Slow-cooked pork shanks sauced with Henry's sweet spicy sauce. Three big honkin' pieces of meat, tasty, fall off the bone, tender, and satisfying. I had a draft birch beer with them. Clear birch beer, another central Pennsylvania delight. I'm glad I went. And with it, right on the way to the in-laws place, might have to stop again. But you see, now I had a hankering for something desserty, so I drove over the ridge to Loganton and stopped at Nan's Donuts. I've been to Nan's before, got my Fosnuts there a couple of times, and it's worth the trip. Nan's is only open on Wednesdays and Saturdays, and Fat Tuesday. Don't ask why, just say thank you. And yes, I've bought into the hype. Nan's Donuts are freaking great. I got a half dozen to take home. Two glazed, a Snickers, dusted with crushed peanuts with a soft nougat cream center, and three powdered cream-filled. Cherry, lemon, and Bavarian. One of the glazed didn't make it home. What makes Nan's Donuts special? Take that glazed. Okay, most glazed donuts are either gut-sinking cake donuts or gauzy, tasteless tissue wrapped in slimy sugar. I'm sorry, but it's true. The Nan's glazed donut walks into the fray and scores a quick takedown. It's a crumbly, delicious shell of glaze around a donut that is neither heavy nor Kleenex-like. Somewhere, the donut gods are nodding. Now that's a donut. And a bonus to Nan's in the warm weather, Yoder's chicken barbecue truck is there. I was too full of pig wings to partake, but the look and the smell almost convinced me to glut myself. Get some. Now, I've told you about judging a beer competition. It's some folks sitting around a table drinking little glasses of beer and then arguing about it. But this past week, I've been judging a whiskey competition, and it's been a lot different. That's largely because of the pandemic. Like a lot of things during the pandemic, whiskey competitions went online. But in the case of whiskey competitions, online has some significant benefits that had nothing to do with restricting the spread of disease. Let me explain. To start the judging, I received a box about twice the size of a shoebox at the beginning of April. In it were 49 50 milliliter sample bottles of whiskey. I'm not exaggerating when I say that over half of them were 100 proof or more, and at least a third of them were over 110 proof. One of the last ones I did earlier today clocked in at a full 131 proof. Now, the way we used to do whiskey competitions, we would ram through 30 or more of these samples in a day. I remember one time I was on the cask strength whiskey panel. We got seven samples that were all at least 120 proof. And by the time we were done, my tongue felt like a slab of rubber. It squeaked when it rubbed against my teeth. I mean, we're not even swallowing. We're spitting every time. But the vaporized alcohol from something like that gets in your lungs, and you get a bit silly. And are you really still tasting? But see, if you're tasting at home, You have 10 days to do those 49 samples. You can pace yourself. So today I did the Irish blended whiskeys and the single barrel rye. I'll do the flavored whiskeys tomorrow, and I'll have a totally fresh palate to do that. Another advantage is that you're no longer subject to the pacing of the slowest or fastest judge. I tend to be the slowest, for whatever reason. But there's no one pushing me to get done. If it takes me an hour to do 5 whiskeys, that's no one's problem but mine. So how do I do it? Because that's all I can tell you. Everyone's a little different. I pour up to 5 samples from the same category, all in the same kind of clean glassware. I use the standard Glencairn whiskey glass. You want everything but the whiskey to be as uniform as possible. I get a big glass of water, my clean spit cup, and get down to it. First, I'll set the category in my mind. Let's say it's one I did on Sunday, single barrel rye whiskey. Okay, so I'm ready for a Kentucky-type rye with a lot of corn, or an MGP-sourced rye with 95% rye, or maybe a Monongahela rye with rye malt and no corn. All right, my brain's set. Pour the whiskey and look at each one, checking for clarity and color. It's usually not an issue, but if it is, I want to know. And then I'll take each one in order, entering my tasting notes in a spreadsheet the competition has designed. In this case, I put in general tasting notes first. I describe what I smell, taking my time and working each sample for a couple of minutes. And then I'll take a sip and hold it on my tongue for a bit. What am I tasting and smelling now? And then I'll spit and see what I taste and smell with an open mouth. I'm looking for identifiable aromas and in what amounts. A lot of aroma is usually better. And how well integrated they are. Do they blend? Do they stand apart? Do they swirl and clash? The latter is not a good sign for me. On the palate, I'm looking for mouthfeel. Light, creamy, oily, cloying, crisp. What flavors am I getting? And are they the same or different from what I got on the nose? How much alcohol heat is present? And is it in proportion to the proof? Is there a lot of tannin or acidity? Is there sweetness? Is it all in balance? And then the spit and the finish. Does it change the flavors? Often wood will come out on the finish. Sometimes it will fade and give way to the other flavors. Alcohol heat often will show stronger on the finish. Is the finish long or short? Is it pleasant? Now that I know the whiskey, I might get deeper into it, go back and check the nose again. If I'm having some trouble with the finish, I may actually swallow a little. I don't do that often. You can't. If it's a truly high-proof whiskey, I'll probably add some water and see what happens. Sometimes it will blossom and show you something new. Sometimes it will simply cool off and let you see it more clearly. And every now and then, it will collapse and give you very little. Then, it's decision time. Did I like what I tasted? Is it a good example of the type? Is it an exceptional example? Is it maybe a best-of-show candidate? If it is, I'll note that at the end of my notes. In any case, at this point, I have to assign a point score within the metal brackets, or not. There are a lot fewer of those these days. Whiskey making is pretty good, but there are still a few. I'll decide on a number and enter it and go on to the next one. Eventually, they're all done, and I usually pull what's left of the ones I like the very best and share them with a friend or my wife. And that's how you judge whiskey these days. Speaking of whiskey, you've heard me talk about my friend Sam Komlenik. I just visited distilleries with him last episode. Well, I saw him again last Friday when West Overton Village dedicated the Sam Komlenik Collection of Whiskey History. Sam's been collecting antique Pennsylvania whiskey bottles and memorabilia for many years, and he's been working with West Overton Village for quite a few years, too. West Overton Village is a historical village with a museum housed in the original Overholt Farm, where Abraham Overholt built his old farm distillery, and where his grandson, Gilded Age industrialist Henry Clay Frick, was born. Sam decided to donate his collection to the museum, and it was a pretty big deal. They had a reception, and the folks from Beam Suntory, who make Old Overholt these days, put on a spread and brought plenty of their new A. Overholt rye whiskey to make cocktails. Jim Huff from Liberty Pole was there, and Herman Mihalik and John Cooper from Dad's Hat Whiskey on the other side of the state. It was quite a night, with whiskey geeks galore and Sam's friends and relations. And then we all went back to the Holiday Inn and drank Dad's Hat and listened to Sam tell whiskey stories. And we celebrated with his wife Amy, who was ecstatic about all the boxes she'd gotten out of the house. That's the show. Thanks to Mike LaRosa for the interview. And once again, it was great to see Sam given the honor he deserves. As always, you can see episode-related pics on Instagram at Stag Podcast and on Facebook at Seen Through a Glass. If you're listening to the show on the radio at WSOV, there are over 30 more episodes to enjoy, including a Milheim episode and a Nittany Valley episode. You can find Seen Through a Glass on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, or on the Podbean app. If you'd like to toss a bit in my hat to keep the show going, I have a coffee button in my Instagram link tree, that's at Stag Podcast, and at the Facebook page. It's an easy way to drop me a few bucks online to help keep this going. If you've already donated, thank you. Henry Clay Frick has a connection to another historic Pennsylvania site, the South Fork Dam. Frick was a founding member of the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club, the group that made alterations to the dam, which would eventually fail and cause the Great Johnstown Flood of 1889. The next episode is a hot one. It's all about hot stuff, hot sauces, hot peppers, maybe horseradish. Better get ready for that one. Until then, thanks for listening. This is Lou Bryson on Seen Through a Glass from the smack dab center of the Keystone State.